Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Well, this week there was something new in Israel, something that has not happened in a decade. Actually, a number of things are new. Among them is the fact that the Likud is not the primary party forming the government. It's now the primary party forming the opposition. Another new thing is that Netanyahu is no longer the prime minister. He's now the head of the opposition. Another new thing is that there is an Arab party forming part of the governing coalition. This has long-term implications, and it's too soon to see what all these implications are. But one thing is for sure, it shows that Israel is a real democracy. There are Arabs in the judicial system at the highest levels, and now an Arab party participates in the government. Another new thing is that the prime minister from one of the smaller parties in the governing coalition. The party of the prime minister holds only 7 seats in the Knesset. There's an agreement that this prime minister, Naftali Bennett, will hold office for 2 years, followed by Yair Lapid, who will hold office as prime minister for the next 2 years. All this assumes that this government will hold office for 4 years. Another new thing is the fact there will be no strictly religious party as part of the governing coalition. This has not happened for many years, and we'll have to soon see the implications are in terms of budgets and the character of the country. So this election has many implications as far as domestic policy, foreign policy, defense policy, and I think more importantly, the very nature and character of the country. Incidentally, two interesting points. The prime minister is a businessman who has made literally tens of millions of dollars and entered politics for what he feels is the good of the country. This is new and unusual. And just as an aside, I know the family of the prime minister Bennett for many years. They're personal friends of mine. So we can only wish them well for the country and for the Jewish people. I'll be back after the break.
The return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel was prophesied in the Bible thousands of years ago and is coming true today. Shalom. Join me, Josh Wander, on Israel Unplugged. Listen in as we delve into the spiritual and physical aspects of the Jewish return to Zion. We'll discuss the biblically mandated, historic, and of course practical understandings of this incredible transition from exile to redemption. That's Israel Unplugged, every Monday on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, this is Jay Shapiro. There's good news and bad news this week. The good news is that Israel had a change of government smoothly in the sense that the new members of the government took their seats, they all made speeches, and it was a smooth change from one coalition to another, and that is something extremely unusual in many places in the world, and particularly here in the Middle East. That's the good news. The bad news is really not as bad as all that, but it's still, in a sense, it's bad news. And that is, although there was a smooth change of government formally, the outgoing government, the members of the outgoing coalition, behaved terribly During the swearing-in ceremony, they shouted, they screamed, they walked out, they behaved like children in a kindergarten, and that is the bad news. Although formally, the news is really good, a smooth change of government, and best hopes for the new government. We're living in a very difficult period of time, and we can only wish good for the new government, whether we agree with it or not, in terms of who makes up the coalition. However, we have to say something about the outgoing prime minister, the Netanyahu. Benjamin Netanyahu has been in office for a long time, 12 straight years. This is in addition to his first term between 1996 and 1999, so he's been in office for about 15 years. However, he underestimated the mood of the country and certainly the political forces that were intent on replacing him. There were noisy demonstrations outside his official home here in Jerusalem every Saturday night for a few years already. Even during the lockdown, when people weren't supposed to go outside, they weren't supposed to go around without masks, there was a mob there every night. And I live about half a mile away from the residence of the prime minister, and we could hear the shouting, and there were police lines and so forth. It was really disgraceful every week. And the fact that even though there was a smooth change of government, the behavior of the outgoing coalition was really disgraceful. There's no other way to describe it. So Netanyahu now takes over the position of leader of the opposition. And we have to go back and review what he did in office. He's been very divisive in the last several years. He's attacked the justice system, the media, the police, anybody considered a political rival. And although his accomplishments are many, which I'll get to in a moment, he really cheapened himself in the manner that he left office. He's leaving the premiership under a cloud of corruption, standing trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Now, a lot of this may not be proven to be true because there are a lot of people who didn't like him, so we don't know what it's going to be. Like any citizen, he should be considered innocent until proven guilty. However, this does not allow him the right to actively undermine the institutions that make up Israel's delicate democratic fabric. His rhetoric has really been bad. And that is his rhetoric that Israelis will remember. He cheapened himself. However, there is a Jewish tradition, it was called out in the Jerusalem Post, called Hakarat HaTov, which means to express gratitude for the good things that were done. I believe he's done fantastic things. He's dedicated his life and his career to the Jewish state. He's been a combat soldier, and he's achieved an impressive list of accomplishments. He very early on realized the need for a corona vaccine acquisition and distribution, and he managed to achieve it even as he was being ridiculed by some members of the new government. And Israel really moved ahead much better in terms of fighting the corona than many countries in the Western world. Also, a big thing is that the Abraham Accords. Israel has normalized relations with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, something that could not have been imagined 10 years ago. The impact of these new relations should not be underestimated. They helped create a real new Middle East to the benefit of all. Now, also, Netanyahu's pushback on the threat from a nuclear Iran was one of the themes that emphasizes his success in office. When most of the Western world was far from seeing the threat of Iran, Netanyahu was fighting it. he spoke to a joint session of Congress, which, by the way, angered the American administration, but was immaterial. He did what he felt was good for the state of Israel, and also, inter alia, it was good for the rest. His approach to this issue played a significant role in preparing the ground for relations with the Sunni Arab states that felt themselves similarly threatened by Iran. Iran is a Shiite Muslim state. The other states around Iran and around Israel are Sunni. They don't like each other too well. Netanyahu was willing to stand up to Barack Obama's in a last-ditch effort to prevent the signing of the nuclear deal in 2015 that the Biden administration is now talking about going back to. Many of the Democrats in America were very angered by this. One of the things that Israel needs in the American Congress is support from both Democrats and Republicans. Everything is interconnected in this area. Netanyahu leveraged Israel's strength to have agricultural expertise, technology, innovation, intel, security expertise. Netanyahu managed that to sell these things and share these things with the world. Under Netanyahu, there were improved diplomatic relations with Russia, China, India, South America, and Africa. While there was a usual criticism in the United Nations of Israel's response to the Hamas rockets just several weeks ago, that's okay. There were several countries, including Austria, Germany, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, and Panama, where the Israeli flag was thrown on government buildings in solidarity during Operation Guardian of the Walls last month. So he unfortunately politicized a lot of Israel's most strategic assets. He was much too chummy with President Trump. It was a very close personal relationship, but it damaged him with the Democrats. These are the facts of life. He also attacked the Biden administration in his speech in the Knesset on Sunday. So that was really a mistake on his part. And we have to remain bipartisan. It's too early now to know how Netanyahu will be remembered in history. It takes time. I remember as a kid when Truman was president, all kind of bad things were said about him. And we look back over the years, and there's no doubt, particularly with the way he ended the Second World War, the use of the atomic bomb, and defending Western Europe against communism, Truman will probably go down in history as one of the great American presidents, even though at the time he was really vilified. I personally remember all that. I was in my teen years, and I was very aware of politics and news, and he was being really criticized terribly. I think history will have a different version of him, and who knows how history will look at Netanyahu. He's been very divisive, but we cannot forget his contribution in transforming Israel into a military and economic powerhouse. There's no two ways about it. So he's still in the Knesset. He's now the leader of the opposition. Who knows how he will behave? It's hard to know. But the things he did that were good, we must recognize, and we must do, as I said at the beginning, what's known in Hebrew as hakarat hatov, recognition of good things that were done, expressions of gratitude. And we owe a lot to Bibi. The next few years, or the immediate future, will determine a lot how he'll be seen in history now that he's the head of the opposition. There is never a dull moment in Israeli politics. as I've said many times on this program, there is a Chinese curse to say to someone, I hope you live in interesting times. That's a curse, and unfortunately, we're living that with that curse for many years. So let's see what happens. I'll be back after the break.
Hi everyone, this is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to throw a few thoughts out on the table concerning what might be the attitude of this new government toward settlement, Jewish settlement in the heartland, particularly in Judea and Samaria, of course, and to really try to understand that you have to keep in mind this coalition is made up of something like 8 different parties which have disagreement about Jewish settlement. It's also supported by an Arab party, which certainly is opposed to Jewish settlement. But I want to say a few words about the new prime minister, about his background. Again, keep in mind that the party that is represented by this prime minister is one of the smallest parties in the coalition. Now, I don't know the prime minister personally. I know his family very well, his parents. His father passed away a few years ago, but there are Americans who came and settled in Israel, and they were tremendous right-wingers, supportive of Jewish settlement. I remember we used to kid around about the fact that every time there'd be some right-wing demonstration, I could look forward to meeting Bennett's parents at the demonstration. I lived in the center part of the country, then I lived in Samaria, and Bennett's parents lived all these years in Haifa, and I didn't have a lot of opportunity to see them, but we always used to meet at demonstrations for settlement. So I know he comes in that kind of background. Also, Bennett, for a period of time, served as Director General of the Yesha Council. The Yesha Council is the umbrella organization for the new municipal councils of settlements in the West Bank. He served as the Director General between January 2010 and January 2012. That's a full 2 years. So what is going to be his attitude towards settlement, and how will this stand up against the United States? He sounded like a right-wing leader that he is in his speech in the Knesset on Sunday, when he said he wants to ensure the national interest in Area C of the West Bank. Area C is the area which is primarily Jewish settlement. So his statement was designed to sound to the Israeli right as if prolonged battle for Israeli control of Area C, which has involved settlement building and the demolition of illegal Palestinian construction, would continue under the new coalition composed of parties that are right-wing, left-wing, and centrist. Now, throughout his career, Bennett has been outspoken and has been clear that he believes that all of Area C, at least where all the Israeli settlements are located, should be part of sovereign Israel. In his Knesset speech on Sunday, he spoke also of his intent to strengthen the settlements throughout the land of Israel. Now, more to the point, while Bennett spoke of the importance of upholding and expanding the peace deals with the Arab nations, he neither pledged his support for a Palestinian state nor offered his hand in peace to the Palestinians. He didn't do this at all. He has long been on record as opposing a Palestinian state. And when he spoke on Sunday in his inaugural speech, he presented the conflict with the Palestinians as an existential one, which it is. He said the following: last month, we received a reminder that the conflict with the Palestinians still exists. We must remember, of course, he was referring to the war we had with Gaza. He went on to say, we must remember and we must remind the world that our enemies deny our very existence as a Jewish state in the land of Israel. This is not a dispute over territory. It's an existential dispute. Now, how will this right wing take on the future of Israeli-Palestinian conflict? How will that sit with his left wing and Arab coalition partners? That's problem number one. The second is, how will his position coexist with a U.S. administration, the Biden administration, bent on preserving the bulk of Area C for a future Palestinian state by preventing further settlement expansion? The Obama administration was vehemently opposed to settlement. The Biden administration is showing signs of the same thing: opposition to Jewish settlement. In his outgoing speech at the Knesset on Sunday, the outgoing Prime Minister Netanyahu said that we've got a lot of friction with the Americans. By the way, he said, the United States was bent on reopening the U.S. Consulate General in East Jerusalem, which the Trump administration had closed. For many years, the East Jerusalem Consulate served as a de facto embassy for the Palestinians, and Trump shut it down, and now Biden is opening it up. So it's interesting. We have a situation which Netanyahu, I think, was able to hold his own for many years against very hostile administration. Even though, for example, at the request of former President Barack Obama, Netanyahu imposed a 10-month moratorium on settlement construction back in 2009 and 2010. He also didn't approve the construction of 3,500 homes in a section of the land between the city of Jerusalem and the city of Male Adumim. And Netanyahu did not authorize all the West Bank outposts. So this is a problem. Netanyahu preferred to wait to do annexation until he had the support of Trump. Trump, of course, is no longer there. So it's hard to know what's going to be. So there's several things I think that are important, though they seem kind of subtle. For example, Netanyahu had a command of English, and Bennett has a strong proficiency in English because, as I said, he's the son of U.S. immigrants, so he should be easily conversed with the Biden administration. Now, Bennett is to the right of Netanyahu politically, but he only has one coalition partner who supports his position. It's another party called the New Hope Party. So Bennett, as the prime minister, will be sandwiched between a U.S. president who opposes his policies on the Israeli-Palestinian track And he will have the opposition of many of his coalition partners. I think there's some like 8 parties in the coalition, some of whom are opposed to settlement. So there's no doubt that it is extremely difficult to know how this new government is going to function. And indeed, it is really difficult to know how long it will last. It's been a long time since Israel put together a coalition that is made up of so many parties that really stand totally different platforms, many of whom are opposed to each other. There are left-wing parties, there are center parties, there are right-wing parties. There are parties that are pro-religion as part of the state. There are parties that are anti-religion as part of the state. It really is, I guess, the way to describe it is a mishmash. It's hard to know what it'll be, but it's challenging. There's never a dull moment in Israeli politics, but I think we're entering now on the threshold of an era which, if this government manages to sustain itself and maintain itself and agree upon those things to which is it agreeable, particularly domestic policy, which most of these parties agree upon. The big problem is foreign relations. The big problem is religion in the state. But there are a lot of domestic issues that all the parties can agree on. And if the leadership of this coalition is clever enough to touch upon only those things to which they agree, then this party has a good chance of maintaining itself for 4 years. Because after 2 years, there's going to be a change of prime minister. And I think the Lapid, who's not the prime minister now, is waiting to be the prime minister in 2 years. I don't think he will want to see this coalition fall apart, and therefore it will probably be a tremendous amount of compromise, more than normally one has in a coalition government of this type. So I guess we can say that Israel is about to enter, or it's entering now, in the threshold of an experiment and a governing by a bunch of parties that have very little to agree upon. So if they agree on those things, we've got a good chance of making it for 4 years. I'll be back after the break.
Are you interested in transforming your life, drawing closer to the Creator, and uncovering the deeper meanings and hidden treasures in the Hebrew Bible?
Then join me, Rav Yitzhak Michelson.
And me, William Hall.
On the Science of Kabbalah, where we are seeking to narrow the gap between what we understand of our physical and spiritual worlds. So make sure to tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Hello, I am Walter Bingham. If you want to hear the news behind the news and the true perspective on world affairs, then the Walter Bingham File is the program for you. We bring you interviews with the movers and shakers, political commentaries, and on-the-spot reports of events as they happen. All here every Tuesday, 4 p.m. Israel time, 9 a.m. Eastern time, and it's all archived on our website. Make it a date.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. It's now been a few weeks since the latest round of fighting in Gaza. And there were pogroms against Jews in the mixed Arab and Jewish cities here in Israel, like the city of Lod. Another problem of the war was Israel's inability to properly frame the war for what it was, a war of defense against a terrorist group that seeks to destroy Israel. Now, as I said, there were pogroms in mixed cities, including Lod and in Yafo. And my only comment about the pogroms was that they smashed the illusion among many Jews that there is such a thing as Israeli Arabs. In my mind, along with many other Jewish Israelis, Israeli Arabs were citizens of Israel with equal rights. They served in the government, hospitals, police, high-tech sectors of Israel's economy, and so forth. Sure, there was a tension among them and their fellow Jewish citizens sometimes, and I do believe that Arabs do experience some form of prejudice here in Israel, in some places. But I believe that Israeli Arabs, unlike the Arabs living in Judea and Samaria and Gaza, saw themselves as full partners in Israel, and that the racism and prejudice that existed are vestiges of the earlier animosity and would soon disappear as Arabs became more and more integrated into Israeli society. Now, it's easy to make an analogy to race relations in the United States, but it is false. The first thing is that African Americans rightfully see themselves as Americans. They demand equality and justice in the name of the same laws in the Constitution of the United States. Even though the Constitution, interestingly enough, was originally drafted by white slave owners, but time has passed, there was a civil war, and things have changed. And there was a big movement during the 1960s for equality. The African Americans seek their share of the American dream as full-fledged citizens of the United States. African Americans may advocate for the special interests of Black Americans, but it is by virtue of being Americans that they seek these rights. And interesting enough that in the Declaration of Independence, which was written by whites, some including some slave owners, the African Americans are now proud to include themselves as part of the story of America. Now, the latest violence by Arab citizens of Israel makes me question whether they see themselves as Palestinians and not Israelis. It seems that they do not share the same vision of Israel as the Jewish state with equal rights for all its inhabitants. This is a touchy question. It seems that they would not add their signatures to Israel's Declaration of Independence if given the chance. I'd like to think that the violence that occurred last month was just a few rotten apples. The Arab community going out of their way to provide kosher food, drinks, and hospitality, for example, to the survivors of the tragedy at Meron on Lag BaOmer just a week before the war is, I hope, a more correct picture of Arabs in Israel. Now, until recently, the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and the Arabs was a metaphor for an impossibly difficult diplomatic situation that simply cannot be solved easily. American media, along with the progressive left, have turned Israel into a white occupying colonizer. They fail to recognize the rights of Jews as the indigenous people of Israel, which in effect erases millennia of Jewish history. The inability by these leftists to see Israel as only protecting itself during the war instead of a shield, is used now as an excuse for anti-Semitism. Complaining that far more Palestinians died than Israelis made me feel that the progressive left was upset that not enough Jews died. Now, until the 19th century, to the middle of the 19th century, hatred of Jews was labeled as Jew hatred. With the entry of Jews into polite European society, then a German agitator by the name of Wilhelm Marr, M-A-R-R, coined the term anti-Semite to distance himself from the vulgarity associated with the hatred of Jews. Anti-Semite is a much cleaner word. After the Holocaust, the term anti-Semite became considered too vulgar, and the term anti-Zionist is now being used. But make no mistake, anti-Zionism is in fact anti-Semitism. Criticizing Israel's policies is fair. Israel, like any other country and any other person, makes its fair share of mistakes. During this war, Israel did in fact kill some innocent Palestinians, but each and every single one of them was either an operational failure or because the Hamas leadership purposely inserted themselves into a civilian area, leaving Israel no choice but to strike in order to prevent further missiles into Israel. Hamas, on the other hand, targets civilians and puts its own civilians in dangerous areas and considers the death of innocent Jews as an operational success. But to question Israel's right to exist or its right to defend itself when thousands of missiles rain down on the country is on the civilian population. To question Israel's right to defend itself is anti-Semitic, I truly believe. So, years ago, they used the word anti-Semite to replace anti-Jew, because anti-Semite seemed like a cleaner word, I guess you could call it. And now you replace anti-Jew or anti-Semite as anti-Israel, which makes it seem like a geopolitical statement. But it's all the same thing. It's anti-Semitism, and there are no two ways about it. So I want to get that off my shoulder. And I want to close the program with an article which I saw the other day about President Biden. According to the article, it reads like this. President Biden, who is in Europe for several high-level meetings, is taking off the morning of June 15 to meet Pope Francis as President of the United States for the first time. That is on June 15, it'll be, which is 2 days before this program is being broadcast. I am actually recording this program on June 15 itself. According to this report, the president's entourage had originally requested for Biden to attend Mass with the Pope early in the morning, but the proposal was nixed by the Vatican after considering the impact that President Biden receiving Holy Communion from the Pope would have on the discussions that they're planning to have during the meeting starting Wednesday 16th. The U.S. bishops are slated to vote on creating a committee that would draft a document called the Eucharistic Conference. Now, according to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, abortion is a grave moral evil that cannot be approved or tolerated in any circumstance. In 2019, a Catholic priest in South Carolina reportedly enforced the Church Code of Canon Law by denying the then former Vice President Biden the sacrament of Holy Communion because of his stance on abortion. Now, according to a priest, Father Robert Morey of St. Anthony Catholic Church, told reporters, "Sadly, this past Sunday, I had to refuse Holy Communion to the former vice president. Holy Communion signifies we're one with God and with each other and with the church. Our actions should reflect that. Any public figure who advocates abortion places himself or herself outside of church teaching." Speaking with the Catholic World Report, they one of the bishops said that Biden should stop defining himself as a devout Catholic while acknowledging that his abortion views stand in opposition to the church. Mr. Biden professes to be a devout Catholic and is 100% pro-choice in abortion. How do you think America's bishop should respond to this situation? The president should stop defining himself as a devout Catholic and acknowledge his view on abortion is contrary to Catholic moral teaching. It would be more honest approach for him to say he disagree with the church. He's acting contrary to church teaching. This is what one of the priests said. When Biden says he's a devout Catholic, we bishops have the responsibility to correct him. Although people have given this president power and authority, he cannot define what it is to be a Catholic and what Catholic moral teaching is. What he is doing now is usurping the role of the bishops and confusing people. He's declaring that he's a Catholic. Is going to force people to support abortion to his tax dollars. The bishops have to correct him. So I just wanted to share this news item about Biden and the Catholic Church. I just think interest. It's under the headlines, but it's of interest. Till next time, Jay Shapiro, time for.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom!
Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling for the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.